Hello, this is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to American History. We continue to read from The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians, host of Bloomberg TV's David Rubenstein Show. David Rubenstein captures the brilliance of our most celebrated historians as well as the souls of their subjects. Last week, we ended the edition of American History with an introduction into the interview and conversation between David Rubenstein and Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts. And now here is their conversation. David Rubenstein, we're very honored tonight to have the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts. Thank you very much for coming. You won't take it as a comment on anything he says. If some people get up and leave between 9 and 9:30, because we understand there might be a vote in the U.S. Senate tonight. Chief Justice John Roberts, or a World Series game, one or the other. Rubenstein, you labor very hard on your opinions, obviously, but you got the most attention I've seen recently for a speech that you gave at the ninth grade commencement of your own son. Why did that speech go viral? What did you say that got so much attention from everybody? Roberts, I didn't even know it was being filmed. What may have caught some eyes is that it was ninth grade, so it was different than most commencement speeches. You can't tell the students that they have reached a great milestone or they're about to go out into the world. I had to think about what was suitable for them. It occurred to me that the start of high school is an important time. For a lot of people, character is really shaped in high school. College will test your character, of course, but in high school you have to go through a few rough things and it shapes what you're going to be like as an adult. Rubenstein, you told the ninth graders you hoped that they had failed, that you hoped that they weren't successful because they would learn more from that. Roberts, if you fail at things in high school, it's usually not that dramatic. I wish them bad luck, because if you experience that, you come to realize that chance plays an important role in life, and you can decide to be bitter about it, or you can decide to understand that success is not entirely due to one's own efforts, neither is failure. Rubenstein, at least from the outside, it doesn't seem that there's been a lot of failures in your own life, Chief Justice. You were a superstar student. You're the Chief Justice of the United States. Let's talk about your background. You're from Indiana. Roberts, I was born in Buffalo, but grew up in Indiana. Rubenstein, were you a good student in high school? I assume you were pretty good. Roberts, the eighth grade class from my elementary school comes and visits the court every year, and one year they brought my permanent record. I mean, it is a permanent record. To be honest, I expected it to be pretty good. It was mixed. There was one year when I got good grades, except for 1D, from what I figure must have been a personal conduct issue. Rubenstein, you must have done well in high school. You got into Harvard. When you got there, did you realize that either everybody there was smarter than you, or that you were smarter than most of the other people there? Roberts, there are some very smart people there. People like Yo-Yo Ma were in my graduating class. Rubenstein, wow, did you know him then? Roberts, no. Bill Gates was also in my entering class. He didn't graduate, of course. Think of how well he could have done if he had stayed in school. Roberts, you graduated in 3 years. How did you graduate from Harvard in just 3 years? Roberts, it's just not that dramatic. If you took enough advanced placement tests and did well enough on them, you could skip your first year. Rubenstein, when you graduated, did you decide to do a gap year or did you want to go right to law school? Roberts, I went straight to law school. The idea of gap years wasn't very common, and my father wasn't that sympathetic to it. Rubenstein, were there lawyers in your family? Roberts, no. Rubenstein, what propelled you to go to law school? Did you know when you went to Harvard that you wanted to go to law school? Roberts, no, I didn't want to go to law school. I wanted to be an historian. I enjoyed history and thought I could make a career out of it. I was driving back to school from Logan Airport in Boston one day, and I talked to the cab driver, and I said, I'm a history major at Harvard. And he said, I was a history major at Harvard. Rubenstein, so you decided to go to law school. Roberts, I thought I would move to law. Rubenstein, I went to law school. In the first year of law school, really in the first month or two, you realize certain people have the ability to quickly do legal reasoning. They have a knack of it, and some people don't. You must have realized that it wasn't as hard as you thought it would be. Roberts, it was as hard as I thought it would be. It was pretty hard throughout. Rubenstein, but you made the Harvard Law Review, which meant you were near the top of your class until you got a clerkship. Did you know when you were in law school that you wanted to be a judge? Roberts, I thought I would practice law. The idea of being a judge did not cross my mind. Rubenstein, you clerked for a very famous judge by the name of Judge Friendly, who was probably the most famous Federal Court of Appeals judge. How was that experience? Roberts, that was transformational. It really was. Harvard Law School at the time, the late 70s, was a pretty cynical place. I think it's changed somewhat, but then it left students with the sense that the law was either the means by which the upper class oppressed the lower class, or it was a tool that could be manipulated to promote particular causes. So I left law school not thinking it was a particularly noble calling. That changed with Judge Friendly. He was somebody who did think that the law had stature of its own, independent from the uses to which it could be put. That the law was something very noble, that the laws were the wise restraints that make men free. To see him not only believe that, but also practice it at the highest level, changed my view of the whole legal profession. Rubenstein, after that you got your clerkship with Justice William Rehnquist of the Supreme Court, was he the Chief Justice at the time? No. What was it like clerking for Rehnquist? Roberts, it was a very different experience. I was not close in age to Justice Rehnquist, but he was at most a generation removed from his law clerks. And Judge Friendly was a couple of generations removed. It was very easy to clerk for Justice Rehnquist. We did not have to do bench memos. He did a lot of the work without the need for a law clerk. He was very crisp in logic and writing style. He had really a whole different style than Judge Friendly, but I was very fortunate to have both clerkships. Rubenstein, when Rehnquist was Chief Justice later on, he was famous, I'm told by some of his law clerks, for having betting pools on everything. Did Rehnquist do that when he was a younger justice on the court? Roberts, yes. Rubenstein, always betting on some various sporting event? Roberts, it was worse than that. He would bet you when the first snowfall would be, or how deep the snow was, and then you'd get outside with a ruler and measure the snowfall. The bets were usually shaped in such a way that he had a real advantage in terms of knowledge. Rubenstein, after you finished your clerkship, you went to work at the Justice Department, and later you went to work in the Reagan White House. I am told that the first day you showed up at the White House, the President of the United States was supposed to call you. What happened? Roberts, the phone rang, I picked it up, and the operator said, could you hold for the President? And I said, yes. I thought it was a very nice thing that President Reagan would call someone on his first day just to say hello. I was holding a little while, then holding longer, and then I started to think, how long should I hold? I thought maybe he's talking to the Soviets, or that he was held up by something else more important going on. So I waited on hold some more. I waited on hold a long time. Then all of a sudden, I heard laughter outside the door to my office. My new office mates had a pull about how long I would just sit there and wait on hold. I don't know who in the pool had 15 minutes as a time period, but he won. Rubenstein, you did that for a while, then you went to practice law in Washington. and then you became a litigator and a Supreme Court appellate lawyer. Roberts, there are some very good trial lawyers here, and I wasn't one of those. I liked to do appellate work, but it really was not a specialty then. You didn't say, I do appeals. Usually the lawyer who tried the case would handle the appeal, so I looked to develop a practice like that. I worked with a more senior lawyer, a fellow named Barrett Prettyman Jr., who did have that kind of practice. I hope to emulate him. Rubenstein, then George Herbert Walker Bush became president, and you get a job in the Solicitor General's office as Deputy Solicitor General of the United States, and you're arguing cases before the Supreme Court regularly. Was that an intimidating experience? Roberts, yes. It is absolutely terrifying. I remember the minute before 10 o'clock when the justices are about to come out on the bench, just thinking, what am I doing this? Why am I doing this? But then as soon as you sit down, you wonder, when can I do it again? It's a very special opportunity. Rubenstein, how long does it take to prepare for an argument in the Supreme Court? A week? Roberts, oh, no, no. If you can arrange it, a couple of months, because there are nine justices. They can ask anything they want. They do. It was a very, very hot bench, as it is today. You just cannot anticipate every hypothetical, every factual question. I started a fresh legal pad whenever I had a new case, and I would just write down every question that occurred to me. By the time of the argument, I would have 500 questions that I had prepared to be able to answer. But I still realized they were going to ask some questions that were not on my list. Rubenstein, so you did that for a while. Then the President of the United States said, I'd like you to be a judge in the D.C. Circuit Court. You were sent up to the Center for Confirmation. What happened? Roberts, the election of 1992 happened. I did not get a hearing before the election, and the president lost, so that was it. Rubenstein, so you went back to practicing law. At that point, did you think your legal career as a jurist was never going to happen? Roberts, I did not think the bus would stop on my block again. No. Rubenstein, so you practiced mostly Supreme Court law. Roberts, yes. Having been in the Solicitor Offices General, I had experience, and so it was a little easier to do. Rubenstein, then you get an opportunity to get on the bench again. George W. Bush becomes president. In 2001, he nominates you to be on the D.C. Circuit Court. Did you get confirmed pretty readily? Roberts, well, I wouldn't go that far. Rubenstein, so you're on the bench for about 2 years. There's a Supreme Court vacancy in 2005 when Justice Sandra Day O'Connor decides to retire. President Bush had some interviews with potential nominees. You had an interview with him. What was that like? Roberts, I was very impressed by the president. It was a much more substantive discussion than I had expected. He had a very considered, educated view of the courts and the relationship with the other branches. I was just very, very impressed. After our conversation, we went out to the Truman balcony at the White House. It was an uplifting moment for me. I felt proud to be an American. But I was teaching a summer session in London at that time, and when the interview was over, I got on the plane and flew back to London to finish the class because I didn't expect to be chosen. As soon as I got there, the White House staff said, "You need to come back again." But they were very careful. They said, "This doesn't mean you're going to get the job." I thought maybe they were still looking at a couple of people. It was a traumatic day because it was the day in 2005 of the London subway bombing, and I was near the cordoned off site of the attack. I figured if I returned to Washington, I was not going to come back to London again, so I got all my stuff. It was hard to get a cab. I got to Heathrow Airport, and there was this very long line of people waiting for a plane. I remember walking to my flight thinking, all these poor people, they're stuck here. That was the line for my plane. The computers had all broken down. I did not think I was going to get out in time. I knew that the White House and that president, if the president's first choice nominee was late, I thought he might just nominate the next person on his list. Eventually got on the plane, but it was very late. I landed at Dulles Airport and made it home just in time to answer the phone call. It was from Harriet Myers, the White House counsel. I was a little disappointed because I assumed she was calling people who did not get the job. But then the president came on the line and offered me the nomination. Rubenstein, so you had a ceremony at the White House, and your son stole the show, as I remember. He was about 4 or 5 then. Roberts, 5 years old. Rubenstein, 5 years old, right. You and the president were talking, and your son was running around in front of you. Was that distracting to you and the president? Roberts, to both of us, as I found out. Jane, my wife, was there with the kids, and I looked over, and our daughter, Josie, was holding her hand, and Jack, my son, was not there. He was in front, and he was dancing around. In retrospect, it is cute. At the time, it was not. Rubenstein, shortly thereafter, Chief Justice Rehnquist dies. The president called you and said, how would you like to be more than just a justice, to be Chief Justice? You didn't have to do another interview. Roberts, yes, it was a very emotional time. Chief Justice Rehnquist died on a Saturday. My hearings were set to begin on the Tuesday. I got the call that Chief Justice Rehnquist had passed away, and President Bush invited me to the White House to talk about it Sunday night. Monday morning, my nomination to be Chief Justice was announced, and Tuesday I was walking up the steps to the court carrying Chief Justice Rehnquist's casket. So there was a lot going on in just those few days. Rubenstein, when you had your confirmation here and you famously said that you're going to be like an umpire, is that because you like baseball? How did that metaphor or analogy come to you? Roberts, a lot of law professors have written articles about how ridiculous the analogy was. They said I did not sufficiently appreciate how difficult it was to be a judge, and I think they did not sufficiently appreciate how difficult it is to be an umpire in baseball. I don't think it's a naive analogy. Basically, you want to make sure you understand that an umpire doesn't make the rules. He applies them. The courts are not Congress. You are not on either team when a case is in front of you. Rubenstein, so you're confirmed as Chief Justice. You're the newest and youngest member of the court, and also the Chief Justice. Was that a little awkward? Roberts, the scenario was worse than that. The court had been together for 11 years without any change, the longest time in modern Supreme Court history. The other justices were all older than I was. They all had vastly more judicial experience than my merely 2 years, and I had been arguing cases in front of them. So I literally had to be, I had been beneath them, looking up to them. To come in as a Chief Justice was a little daunting. I was always be grateful for how they made me feel welcome and comfortable. In conference, the Chief Justice presents the case and says what he thinks ought to be done. But I did not know quite how it worked. So at my first conference, I called on Justice Stevens, and then Justice O'Connor, then Justice Scalia. And pardon me, then Justice Scalia said, "What is this all? That's John, that's Sandra, I'm Nino," and he said, "You're the Chief." It was a real gripping moment to realize I had the support of the court, not because they thought I was in any way superbly qualified for the position, but they realized that somebody had to occupy that role and they're going to be supportive of me in doing that. And that meant a lot to me. Rubenstein, explain how the court decides what cases it's going to hear. What is a writ of certiorari, for instance? Roberts, the writ of certiorari is an old law term. And that's all I know. We get about 8,500 to 9,000 of these petitions every year from people who want us to hear their case. And we will hear fewer than 1% of those cases. There are some that we will almost surely always take. If a lower court has held an act of Congress unconstitutional, we will decide that question as a matter of comedy with the legislative branch across the street. Typically, though, it is a conflict question. To take the simplest example, say if the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in California says you can deduct these taxes on your federal return, And the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York says you cannot do so. It has to be the same answer throughout the country, so we will take that case. Which is why a lot of cases in our docket are not terribly interesting. They are conflicts in interpretation of federal laws that need to be resolved by us. That is the easiest way to get a case brought to the Supreme Court. Rubenstein, you need four justices to agree to hear a case. Roberts, right. Rubenstein, do you actually talk about the cases that you're going to hear? Roberts, we review 150 cases a week. All the justices look at them through whatever system each justice has, and we put on the discuss list all cases anyone wants to talk about. Of those 150 for each weekly conference, there might be a dozen that we will want to talk about, and we'll talk about each of those. Rubenstein, let's suppose you've agreed to hear a case and the case is argued. Before the argument, does every justice actually read all the briefs, or do they skim them? They can't read all the amicus briefs, I assume. Roberts, sometimes we can. In some cases, there'll be six or seven amicus briefs, or friends of the court, and we can read those. In one of the big marquee cases, it might be 80 amicus briefs. I do not read that many. I do read the summary of argument of each one. And I'll pick ones that I think are important. If it's a labor case, for example, I will likely read an amicus brief from a national labor union because of its perspective. Then my law clerks will read all 80 of the briefs and they will say, you should read these seven or eight. Rubenstein, before the oral arguments, the justices do not talk about the cases other than when they've granted the writ of certiorari. Roberts, certainly not in any formal way, not at conference, not walking down the halls. People come to the arguments on their own. Rubenstein, when an argument is being made in front of the Supreme Court, the justices ask questions. Are they asking questions because they want the answers, or because they want to influence other justices, or do they just want to make a public point? Roberts, we do not ask questions to make public points, but we ask questions for a number of different reasons. Sometimes you just have a question and you want to know the answer. Sometimes you formulated in your mind a tentative view and you think, well, it does depend on this, and you'll ask that question. If a justice asks a question and it reveals to me that the justice is focused on something in a particular way, and I see it differently, I might ask a follow-up question so that the lawyer can have an opportunity to make us all comfortable with an answer. Sometimes it's like Wimbledon. I remember one exchange, I think it was between Justice Scalia and Justice O'Connor. Justice O'Connor says, I don't think there's any jurisdiction here in this case. And before the lawyer can answer, Justice Scalia jumps in and says, well, there's diversity between the corporation, isn't there? And before the lawyer can answer, Justice O'Connor jumps in and says, well, but the corporation's principal place of business is here, isn't it? The lawyer is standing there looking back and forth. Finally, it gets to the point where Justice O'Connor asks another question, and the lawyer turns to look back at Justice Scalia. He leans over and says, you're on your own. Rubenstein, when a justice asks a question and the lawyer says, I'll get to that later, that's a bad answer, right? Roberts, yeah, that does not usually work. Rubenstein, are justices' opinions rarely really changed by oral argument, or does it really not affect the outcome of the case? Roberts, oral argument is a very important part of the process. I had been on the arguing side for 20 years, so I would have been very disappointed if that turned out not to be the case. It is part of a process of winnowing down. You read the first brief, you think, well, that sounds right. You read the other side's brief, well, maybe that's right. The oral argument is part of the winnowing down until you get to a decision point. You may have particular issues you want to talk about. You might have hypotheticals to eliminate them. You learn for the first time what your colleagues think about the case. It is the first time you learn, for example, that Justice Neil Gorsuch might think that there is a jurisdictional issue. He hadn't thought about it, so you react to that. And you might have thought you knew how one justice was going to proceed, but his question reveals a totally different perspective, So you look at that. It is very, very hard for the advocates because they have to juggle all these different data points. But it is exhilarating. I enjoy being on both sides. Rubenstein, we have a Supreme Court bar in the United States now. We had one in the beginning of the country's history. Do you ever feel sorry for the lawyer who has never argued in front of the Supreme Court and just doesn't know how to do it? Roberts, if they do not know how to do it, yes. But there is a very sophisticated Supreme Court bar. It is very, very good. We are very fortunate that we have lawyers who specialize in that practice because it is not like arguing in a state court or even a court of appeals. In a half hour there will be 100 questions and you have to know how to field them. We all have a romantic image, a sort of Mr. Smith goes to Washington image of the lawyer with the battered briefcase and he's there all alone. That happens sometimes. I remember one occasion in which a lawyer said, "Well, that's pretty much all I have. I just want to say this has been the experience of my life." I do not remember if he won his case or not, but it takes an enormous amount of work, and for a solo practitioner to devote months to preparing it, you just can't do it. Rubenstein, can you tell when an experienced Supreme Court practitioner is making an argument only to win the vote of a justice who it's well known has a certain point of view? Is that apparent to the other justices when that happens? Roberts, yes, an experienced Supreme Court advocate will not do that. You really do have to have an overarching concept of your case. If you say, "Oh, Justice so-and-so did this," that will annoy the other justices. Well, that's all the time we have today for the conversation between David Rubenstein and Chief Justice John Roberts. We'll conclude their conversation next week in the next edition of American History. And that will wrap up our reading from The American Story, after which we'll start a new book. The book is This Land Is Your Land by author Beverly Gage that came out this year. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for listening.